So what do we do? Do you want to call on people? Should I call on people? Okay, yes, well, you're in charge, so we'll give you the chairperson's prerogative, so go ahead.
Recognize that what's happening in explaining the rise in inequality under the skill bias technical change argument, what's happening is that the increase in demand for skill hasn't been met by an increase in the supply for skill.
Right.
And a lot of people say the great thing about the rise in inequality is, of course, it's sending a much needed signal, namely get skill.
Right.
And we should embrace at least that signal because it's a needed one. But that then raises the question why that signal hasn't been met with increase in the supply. That's been out there for a long time, and we would expect a compensating increase in the supply of high skilled labor. So what is the seeming block, and how what might be the policy response? You talked at the end a bit about the importance of, as I took it, an expansion in public education.
Well, not an expansion of dollars so much as, but let me rattle off a whole series, because your question is right on target. First, to the extent that we think of the public education system as the supply side of this response mechanism, this is not a private sector activity in which incentives alone matter. This is now a matter of public policy, and saying that something ought to happen is a very different matter than saying that it will happen. So remember, this is, you know, public policies happen because we, the voters, make them happen, not happen on their own. Second, there are to the extent that lots of children arrive in school unable to learn, then no matter what you do in the public school system, starting from K through 12, you're not going to have a lot of impact, certainly on the lower tail of people. That's where the Head Start argument comes in. Third, higher education, to the extent that that's what we're talking about, is limited in a variety of ways. It's very difficult just to go start up a new college. I understand that Mr. Stanford did it many years ago, but it's hard to do this. And this has to do with access. This is a place where I cited Heckman's work approvingly a few minutes ago. This is a place where I have a serious argument with Heckman. Heckman did a long series of papers, the conclusion of which was that only 8% of American young people are not getting the higher education that they deserve because of inadequate funding. Now, incidentally, David was kind enough to mention that I write frequently for the New York Review. A key lesson of writing for any students in the room is that the most important word in any sentence is always the adverb, always the adverb. So when Heckman says that the finding is that only 8% of American young people are not getting the higher education that they ought, for which they're qualified, my reaction is, I believe you're 8%, but what do you mean only? See, Heckman thinks about this as only 8% because it's only 8 out of 100. My view is that the college completion rate in the United States is 28%. And if you think about the 8% as compared to the 28, I think the adverb makes no sense whatsoever. So making college more affordable and more widely available is yet a third thing that, again, this is not something that's just going to happen for incentives. And then I'll list one more before I stop talking about this. And here's one where I don't really know much about what to do. There is a widely recognized market failure in the market for on-the-job training provided not by the schools but by the companies. That market failure is attributable to the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, namely no slavery. That is to say, any firm that provides training to its workers immediately has to face the prospect that the worker will turn around and go work, take the training and work for somewhere else. The example with my own background, the example that's most prominent in mind is Merrill Lynch. For years and years and years, Merrill Lynch has been the major training ground for stockbrokers in the United States. Merrill Lynch regularly loses approximately 50% of the brokers that they train. There's nothing they can do about this. They just do it. Now, would Merrill Lynch provide better training for stockbrokers if they knew that they would be able to retain people for at least 5 years? Well, of course. Would the country be better off? That's another question. But there are lots of businesses that could usefully train people in ways that would make a difference, and they don't, because they can't, once they've trained people, they can't prevent them from walking out the door. So these are four, and there must be many more, but these are just four immediate answers to the question, why don't the incentives work? Over a long enough period, presumably things will happen, but there's more than just letting the incentives operate, and I think for reasons that I said at the outset, I think the distribution matters, and it's a matter of some urgency for the United States today. So I would like to press forward with policies rather than just hope incentives ultimately kick in. Yes, a hand there very early on. Please.
Could you say a word about how race and gender affect the dynamics?
What can you say about race and gender? Fortunately, I don't know what you mean by dynamics, fortunately, the black-white gap has been narrowing, albeit slowly. And fortunately, the male-female gap has been widened. I may have misspoken. The black-white gap has been narrowing, but slowly, and the male-female gap has been narrowing pretty rapidly. And so these are good things. And to the extent that those gaps are attributable to sheer discrimination, then of course one wants to get rid of the discrimination, and that's worth doing for reasons that stand on their own two legs very, very well. For reasons that, to the extent that these gaps have to do with differential education, then one hopes that addressing them through other policies. My sense is that we have a problem now that now transcends the both the black-white gap and the male-female gap. And I, as a matter now of political economy, I would be averse to getting the need for action to arrest the widening inequality to getting that tangled up in the male-female and black-white gap. Not that those aren't regrettable, but I think it would be the wrong message for the country at large to think this is discrimination problem. That's not what's going on.
Well, just one follow-up. Certainly, with respect to gender, you know, education, when you control for education, you still see a substantial...
Yes. It's still there. No question. It's still there.
And the question would be, as a policy matter, would you want to take some additional steps just as correctives for that? For example, the Paycheck Fairness Act that's been voted about in Congress as a way to...
I don't know about that legislation, but I would go back to what I said before. To the extent that there is, that parts of the gap are due to pure discrimination, then absolutely we should get rid of that. But once again, we should get rid of that for reasons that to me stand on their own, because discrimination is opprobrious. And the fact that getting rid of the discrimination would help narrow these gaps is nice, but I don't even think we need that. Discrimination is wrong and should be abolished. So, I agree. Mark?
Well, I'm very interested in this discussion of a tax on height. I think because you and I are the same height, it also sounds very reasonable to me. And I guess the argument is that there is excess income associated with height. It's a rent. You could tax it, because if you tax it, people won't get shorter. That's not how height is applied. That is presumably politically a non-starter to have tax. So my question is there some tax policy that you can imagine or have in fact suggested that would make the same kind of argument, but that would be politically...
No, I can't think of any way that would be politically a starter, to use your phrase, but what it does do, you see, is undermine the presumption against higher rates of marginal taxation for higher income groups, because to the extent that... See, I would take three levels. That first, there's an argument, the Nozick type argument, that people have a property right that should be inalienable in their earned incomes. I just dismissed that right away. Second, what about people's earning a return on their marginal product? Well, that is there you have to balance seriously the provision of factors of production versus, so there's the efficiency argument versus the just desserts argument. In the middle between the two, you have the rents argument, where there's no, as you put it, nobody's going to get any shorter. So now, let's say that Greneventer earns five times as much as Friedman does. Now, let's figure this out. How much of this has to do with sheer greater genius, greater effort, greater pride, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You can tell that story. How much of this has to do with things that are supplied with zero elasticity and could not be withdrawn, and how much has to do with things that could be withdrawn, knows not your greater genius, but your greater work effort than mine. And the more you tip the argument, or the more you tip your sense of who earns more and who earns less, in the direction of things that are supplied inelastically, like height, like luck, like whatever, the more you create a case for the just desserts taxation. That's what I'm really after. I had a section in my notes on exactly that. I was going to talk about that. That it struck me that I would think the answer would be yes. That there should be a way of making spectrum of various elements in your. Suppose we did a factor analysis on individuals' earnings. And we came up with say 20 factors. Now they're not going to be all equal, but you look at each one and say, well, height is at one end of the spectrum, so that's pure rent. How about education? Well, now we can parse that out about to what extent is that native ability, to what extent is that people work hard. Maybe that's not 100%, maybe that's 50%. So I guess what I'm saying is that I can see a way of taking the leading elements in the factor analysis of earnings differentials and assigning them someplace on the spectrum. It's a technical, to me it's a technical measurement task, not a conceptual task. I think it's conceptually straightforward, but technically would be hard. Yes?
Can you elaborate on the idea that by increasing skills, we increase median income? I understand that if there's a demand for high-skilled workers and more people get highly skilled, more people will get paid, or it might even drive the wage down, but then
not automatically, by the market process that asks why are janitors' wages so low? The answer is, at least in my state, janitors' wages are pretty low. This is a topic of conversation at my university. I don't know if it is here. The answer to why janitors' wages are so low is that there happen to be a lot of people who don't have the skills to compete for any other job, and therefore they're stuck being janitors. And so as you take more and more of those people and enable them to do something other than being janitors, you reduce the number of people applying for the janitorial positions, and therefore in order to attract the janitors, the wage has to go up. You see, this is incidentally a standard argument. It comes up in its sharpest form in the immigration debate. Often people say, well, we have to have all these immigrants because Americans won't do, and you fill in the blank, whatever the job is. Well, the reason Americans won't do the job is that the wages are so low. And the benefit, in the, you know, wages, given the unpleasantness of the job. And if the immigrants if the low-skilled immigrants weren't there taking those jobs, then, you know, are the streets going to go unswept? Is the garbage going to go uncollected? The answer is no. The employers who pay the people for doing those jobs are going to discover that they can't get people at the current wage, and they're going to have to raise wages. So yes, somebody will always be in those jobs, but then the question is at what rate, and the need to attract people. Again, to take classic economist example, Ken Arrow's nephew uses this example all the time. Why is it that barbers' wages are higher today than they were 200 years ago? There's been no productivity increase in the haircutting industry in the last several centuries. The reason is that there's been tremendous productivity increases elsewhere in the economy, and therefore the rest of the economy pays higher and higher and higher wages, but people still need to have their hair cut, and therefore, if you're going to get anybody to be a barber, you better pay a competitive wage or else nobody's going to do that. And so it's the same thing. So it's not that the janitors or the guy who picks up my garbage in front of my house will be a higher productivity person. It's that with people being competed away into other professions, those jobs will pay more. So yes, I absolutely would see the wage diffusion going down. Ken, you had a
question. Yes, I wanted to go back to your attitude, the earlier part of your talk about the attitudes.
Okay.
And I think you made a number of generalizations about the effect, let's say, of low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the word you use, but you know, if there's a sense that progress isn't being made, mm-hmm. you're saying there's also sort of, roughly called antisocial mm-hmm. consequences. Now, one of them is the income distribution itself. There used to be a view that the masses are oppressed, they're going to rise to revenge, they're going to do something about it. What you're suggesting, if I understand correctly, is that if you have inequality in the sense, not the inequality, but the sense of no progress, which is kind of what followed from the inequality of growth, you know, overall growth, will lead to will tend to go to anti-distributionists. Now, to some extent, the present situation does tend to support your view. The low, I'm amazed at that low taxes are such a mantra. That everybody's afraid to say low taxes, since anyone might think that those at the lower end of the income distribution might be very happy to see taxes raised to supply more social services, reduce taxes on poor, various redistributionist measures. On the other hand, the New Deal doesn't seem to be quite fit that thing. Here we have certainly an expectation that things were going to help. And one of the consequences was, for example, the pro-union measures, which were thought of at least. People will argue with their work, but most of us thought it was a highly redistributionist measure, the way by which the workers could get higher wages. And there was a lot of support for that, and it went through. Taxes on the rich were raised, at least toward the end of the period, and so forth. So it looks like the New Deal, which really, the sense that you were going down, was much more prevalent, it was a situation much worse than anything we faced in recent times, nevertheless led to a strength redistribution. So I don't quite find the order. Spell out what is the relationship between a sense of loss or a sense of not gaining and taking active redistributive measures.
Well, the answer is you are absolutely right about the New Deal. That in my recent book, I walk through about 150 years of history of the interaction of the economics and the politics and the social movements and the attitudes in the United States. And I divide it up into something like 8 or 9 periods. And the one that absolutely does not fit is the New Deal. Absolutely does not. And rather than doing the usual economist's thing of muttering something about outlier observation and waving my hands and sweeping it under the rug, I chose the opposite approach, and I actually spent more time on the New Deal in the book than on anything else. I have an entire chapter, and I think the title of the chapter is Great Depression, Great Exception, because absolutely you're right, the New Deal does not fit, and I just make no attempt whatsoever to fit that experience. I argue that all of the other time periods for the U.S. do. Then I offer some conjectures, and I use the word conjecture very carefully because I don't pretend to have researched it. The hypothesis that I came up with for the conjecture I came up with for the New Deal is that there might be some nonlinearity having to do with the extreme circumstances, that if we're simply stagnating and I'm just not getting ahead, then I behave the way my model suggests. But there might be some tension point at which if we all have the feeling that this is just, we're all in it together going downhill, maybe we behave in a different way. A little bit like the, you know, we're familiar with models like the strong and the weak nuclear force. You know, if you get two protons that are at this distance, they repel. If you get them to this distance, they repel. If you get them to this distance, they repel. And if you put them like that, they attract. You know, I think the weak nuclear force I may have it backward. But the point is, you can easily imagine a story in which people having a sense that the whole world is falling apart and we're going down and we're all in it together would incidentally, and I should say, for obvious reasons, I didn't go into what the model was. I just stated my hypothesis about growth. There is a model behind it, and I conjecture in the book that circumstances like the New Deal might be sufficient to render my model inoperative, which I guess is another way of saying there's a meta model of which my model is a piece. But I didn't try to do the meta model. But you correctly honed in on the one period, I would argue, in the last 150 years that absolutely goes the wrong way for my hypothesis. You look like you're about to say we're through.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time, so I'd like to thank our speaker.
Thanks very much.